Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Craig Cox, the Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Environmental Working Group. He has worked for the National Academy of Sciences, the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition and Forestry, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and as Executive Director of the Soil and Water Conservation Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Cox.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And the president is expected to sign the farm bill that passed out of the House earlier and the Senate, and it comes to about $956 billion over 10 years. That's roughly $1 trillion. It has less than half of the $38 billion in savings that the president had called for. And the savings it has seem to have come out of the poorest of our citizens, where almost a million American families are going to be affected with cuts in food stamps. So why are they calling this a bipartisan victory?
Well, we certainly don't call it a bipartisan victory. We think it's a major missed opportunity to really put in place a farm policy that that meets the needs of the people in this country. And I think what you're seeing in this farm bill is at least the farm policy pieces of this bill are still being written to satisfy the demands of agriculture from the taxpayer instead of really thinking about what does the public need from agriculture.
So it's another way of saying that this is ultimately a victory for the agricultural lobbyists, that they've sort of ground down the reformers.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, if you follow the money, I think that story becomes quite clear. Exactly 81% of the savings from ending some traditional farm subsidies that is being touted as reform are in fact plowed back into a new suite of subsidies that are likely worse for taxpayers than the subsidies they are replacing, and certainly worse for the environment.
And these are the agriculture risk coverage and a supplemental coverage option. So they're celebrating the idea that you no longer have direct payment subsidies, which result in a lot of farmers not getting paid for not planting crops. They're making the suggestion here that this is a more equitable form of insurance because it's based upon what weather conditions. I mean, I don't understand. Obviously, none of our audience would be sympathetic to the idea that you pay people not to grow things. But what is it exactly about this new regime that is so beneficial to both the farmer and the taxpayer?
Well, it's certainly beneficial to the farmer, at least some farmers, not all farmers. And the first thing we need to make clear is that the crop insurance program in the last 8 or 9 years has really moved far away from what most people would consider an insurance program. And it's really become an income support program.
You mean like welfare?
Yes, and it guarantees a certain, it guarantees a certain revenue per acre. Now, the farmer producer does need to pay part of the cost of securing that policy, so it's not exactly like welfare, but the program is heavily subsidized by taxpayers. About, on average, taxpayers pick up 60 to 62% of the producer's premium. They pay crop insurance companies $1.3 billion a year to sell and service these federally subsidized policies. And the program is sort of rigged to make sure that these private insurance companies get most of the underwriting gains and the taxpayer picks up most of the losses. I mean, as a result, the crop insurance program is far more expensive than the direct payment program that's being replaced. In fact, if if most of what goes in, you know, after this farm bill, the crop insurance and these new programs are likely to cost well over twice as much as the direct payments did. So it's not better for the taxpayer.
Well, apparently there are no means testing in terms of how the money is spent, that people making up to $900,000 in adjusted gross annual income can qualify for payments. So why is there no means testing? And apparently Senator Grassley has objected to it because it has no limit on the number of people per farm that can qualify for payments when so many farms are businesses. So in effect, the taxpayer ends up subsidizing the employees of a corporation, and so they don't have to pay them their salaries. Is that the loophole we're talking about?
Yes, that loophole remains. Mm-hmm. And Senator Grassley fought very hard to close that loophole. In fact, he succeeded in getting his provision in both the Senate version of the Farm Bill and in the House version, exactly the same language in both bills. And yet the conference committee went ahead on their own and stripped that provision out and kicked it to the administration to write rules. So that's really unprecedented. And conference committees are not supposed to change legislation that is contained in both House and Senate versions of the bill. They're only supposed to resolve differences.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Cox, the Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Environmental Working Group. He has worked for the National Academy of Sciences, the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition and Forestry, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and as Executive Director of the Soil and Water Conservation Society. So that in itself is very troubling, the idea that in the back room they can override the will of both of the houses. So who was pushing for this idea that, I mean, am I correct in suggesting that this is a form of welfare payments for agribusiness? Because, you can basically have all of your managers, their salaries paid for by the federal government.
Well, I don't think you can have their full salaries paid for, but it is a huge loophole that's been effectively used by the largest and most complex partnerships and corporations to multiply many times the amount of government subsidies that they are supposed to get, including, and the way it works is they include they include their farm workers or other folks as actively engaged in the management of the farming operation, and then harvest subsidies because they have 8 or 10 people eligible to get subsidies in that partnership.
And how could you distinguish between corporate farming and family farming? Because, the family tends to put all of its kids to work, don't they?
Well, what Senator Grassley had proposed was a set of criteria that would have to be met for someone to be considered, quote unquote, actively engaged in the farming operation. So they would have to demonstrate that they are spending, a significant amount of time on the farming operation, that they have some financial interest in the operation. But he wanted to write in statute some clearer criteria for how USDA would make this determination. And that's the fundamental problem now, is that there are no really clear, strict, effective criteria.
So, Craig Cox, the other aspect of it that I mentioned in the opening, and I suppose in terms of, you clearly feel that this new farm bill is in effect a kind of bait and switch, and that the benefits that are being touted are extremely dubious. And I suppose given that, the fact that even though it's a 10-year bill of nearly $1 trillion, after 5 years, it can be modified, right?
That's exactly right. And in fact, It may be modified sooner than that if this bill suddenly begins to spend far much more money than was anticipated, and there's a high potential for that to happen.
So when the Michigan Democratic Senator, Chairwoman of the Agriculture Committee, Senator Debbie Stabenow, says this is not your father's farm bill, it's a new direction for American agriculture policy, I take it you don't buy that.
Well, I think it is a new direction for agriculture policy. It's just not a very good direction.
Mm-hmm.
It is a departure from the traditional structure of the way taxpayers supported farm income, with one big exception, and it's really substituting this really pumped up crop insurance program for the traditional subsidies as the way taxpayers are going to support farm income, and there's some real problems with transforming crop insurance, which is supposed to be a safety net, into essentially an income support program.
Well, I keep going back to the food stamp cuts, even though, again, people are saying, well, it's not as bad as it could have been if we would have gone with the House version instead of the Senate version. And the current bill that the president's about to sign cuts food stamps by $8 billion over the next decades. But that in itself still reduces benefits for 850,000 households across the country. And I don't understand how you could prioritize crop insurance and all the stuff we've been talking about, all these people getting subsidized in this way that Senator Grassley tried to clarify so that, you know, people weren't just being able to inflate the numbers on paper in order to get more and more subsidies. I mean, it just feels to me completely out of whack that you're talking about billions on the one side being thrown in to a big, generous pot, and then taking money out away from 850,000 households who are already incredibly poor. People who are on food stamps don't choose to be on food stamps. They're not freeloaders. These are people who are really in trouble. They are what the Bible calls the least among us.
Well said. It's horrendous, misguided priorities to take money away from working families, and many of the benefits flow to hungry kids, in order to beef up benefits to some of the most financially secure farming operations in the country. It's outrageous, and the salt in the wound is it's totally unnecessary. If they wouldn't have done this bait and switch that we just discussed and instead just ended these, you know, totally discredited direct payment programs, there would have been plenty of money to exceed the deficit reduction that the committees are claiming for this farm bill and not cut food stamps at all, and instead invest in new programs or existing programs that actually help people eat healthier.
So does this then, Craig Cox, come down to the power of the agribusiness lobby? Is that why we ended up with what we ended up with, as opposed to what you just suggested we could have had in a, I was going to say a more perfect world, but maybe I should say a less corrupt world?
I think it's an indication of the power, the continuing power of the agriculture subsidy lobby, which is now augmented with the crop insurance lobby, because crop insurance companies are making huge profits through this federally subsidized insurance program. And, you know, the fundamental problem that we faced in farm bill after farm bill is it's just difficult to get members of Congress who aren't in farm states really engaged in shaping the farm bill.
Well, apparently a lot of the votes come from farm states, and there's an odd thing going on in Arkansas where Senator Pryor is supposedly vulnerable, and he's being challenged by a Republican congressman who actually voted against the farm bill because he's a Tea Party guy who felt that it was too expensive. And yet the other senator from Arkansas, who's a Republican, voted for it and praised it. So you can see the politics of it. And how do you think the politics are going to play out in terms of in rural America? Do people just basically want the money? They don't care about any budget-busting aspects of it?
You know, that's really hard to predict. I mean, it seems to us, when you look back at previous elections, that the Farm Bill has not really played a big role in the outcome of local elections, at least as far as we can see. I think it's been overplayed as an important bill for local elections, except in, you know, those districts that are really dominantly agricultural.
Well, but the irony that I see is that, you know, you have in red state America very conservative politics, you know, Republican and, you know, very Christian right kind of people get reelected fairly regularly, and they all campaign on free market values and freedom, etc. And yet, you know, what we were talking about in terms of this farm bill is how much it's really a form of welfare. So does that irony ever come up in the politics of rural and red state America?
Certainly. A number of people, especially, you know, journalists, have pointed out this irony, or perhaps better called hypocrisy, especially this time around when we're talking about hurting poor and hungry people while beefing up government benefits to millionaires. It's been repeatedly brought forward. It doesn't seem to affect the outcome, unfortunately, this time around.
So, Craig, I detect a certain weariness in your voice. When are you going to come out fighting, and with what?
Well, we fought really hard for the last 2.5 years on this bill, and we did harvest a couple of important victories, especially on the environmental side. There's a critical provision, you know, known as conservation compliance, that asks farmers to take some basic measures to protect soil and water and wildlife habitat in return for these generous subsidies. That provision was in serious risk of being eliminated in this farm bill, and we managed to make sure that it's still there. And there are some increases in support for some good food and healthy food programs. There are some improvements in the conservation programs, but they're unfortunately just so far outweighed by these really, really bad priorities and this new subsidy mechanism that is just really unwise. So we're going to, you know, we're not through fighting. There's a lot of fights to be fought as this farm bill becomes implemented. There's a lot of opportunities to shape it in ways that make it less bad. I do think if there's still a lot of attention on the federal budget, that the budget busting potential of this bill could put it right in the bullseye for finding savings even before the next farm bill. So we're not giving up by any means.
Well, Craig Cox, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Craig Cox, who's the Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Environmental Working Group. He has worked for the National Academy of Sciences, the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition and Forestry, the United States Department of Agriculture, and is Executive Director of the Soil and Water Conservation Society. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the unprecedented rebuke of the Catholic Church by the United Nations.